Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Gerald Loughlin. Gerald Loughlin is now a lecturer in the Master of Professional Writing program at the University of Southern California and a professor emeritus of English at California State University, Long Beach, where he taught from 1965 through 2007. He is the author of over 125 books and chapbooks of poetry, fiction, and criticism, with over 3,000 poems, stories, articles, reviews, and interviews published in periodicals. His most recent books and chapbooks include new and selected poems by World Parade Books, the Cezanne Pizarro poems also from World Parade, New Orleans, Chicago, and Points Elsewhere from RV Press, Wedlock Sunday and Other Poems, Liquid Paper Press, Nerve Cowboy Magazine, The Ristorante Godot, Bottle of Smoke Press, and the San Antonio, Savannah, and Daytona Beach Poems from Pitchfork Press. His full-length books from Water Row Press include Charles Bukowski, A Sure Bet, and many others. He has resumed, along with his son Zachary, co-editing the poetry for the Chiron Review. And we're so happy to welcome you here, Jerry. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. I love being here.
Yeah. So you have so many poems, but I've asked you to pick and choose. So I'm curious as to what you're going to read. So go ahead.
Okay. You asked me about my daughters last night. I have four daughters and three sons. And this is one for a daughter, and I have some others. They're the poems that you work the hardest on, I think, because you want to get them just right. If they're about people who are dear to you like that, you don't want to have any wrong notes in them. The best year of her life. When my two-year-old daughter sees someone come through the door whom she loves and hasn't seen for a while and has been anticipating, she literally shrieks with joy. I have to go into the other room so that no one will notice the tears in my eyes. Later, after my daughter has gone to bed, I say to my wife, "She will never be this happy again." And my wife gets angry and snaps, "Don't you dare communicate your negativism to her." And of course I won't if I can possibly help it. And of course I fully expect her to have much joy in her life. And of course, I hope to be able to contribute to that joy. I hope, in other words, that she'll always be happy to see me come through the door. But why kid ourselves? She, like every child, has a life of great suffering ahead of her. And while joy will not go out of her life, she will, one of these days, cease to actually, literally, jump and shriek for joy. Another one to a daughter is the bunny fish. It's what I called my daughter when she was very young and just learning to swim. I would pick her up from lessons at the outdoor pool, and every morning she would emerge with teeth chattering. She was so slender, so sleek, her hair wetted back and a frown creasing her brow. I'd sweep her into a long, thick towel, hug her up into my arms, and hurry her to the car, her cold cheek against my warm neck, rush her home to a hot shower. Now she's a teenager, and these are not easy years for her or for me. She thinks I protect her too much, that her friends have more freedom, more fun, and maybe they do. You always hear that you have to let children learn from their mistakes. But I don't think you have to let them make mistakes before they're even out of high school, out of the house, if those mistakes might curtail their lives before they even have a chance to live. So in the necessary tug of war of these years, the tension of her struggle for independence, I representing civilization, she, the discontents of those whose freedom is restricted, I try at least to slow things down a little, to let her have a chance to grow into the capacity to make the decisions she will have to make, And I try to assure that she will have the base of education that will afford her a life lived as her own woman. Invariably, though, we are sometimes hurtful to each other in our sarcasms and silences. And if I err in exaggerated fears, or am sometimes tempted to flee into the refuge of no longer caring, from which I am always brought back by the immensity of how much I do care, I can only hope that she will one day realize how often she has been all that I lived for, how I gradually turned myself into a different person so I would be a better father for her, starting back when she was first her old Dawes bunnyfish, shivering in my arms, which were still then powerful. I turned my life towards her then, and now I am simply seeing it through to the end, an ignorant man in an even more ignorant world, making mistakes, but making them out of love for her.
You know, you're known, you know, widely as an irreverent poet, someone who has no patience for, I think, the ordinary, the everyday boredoms that many people live with. And it's kind of interesting to me that you're starting with the daughter poems and talking about, you know, writing about people who are dear to us and with care. Did you start off writing tender poems, or you've written over 100 books, which I don't even understand to begin with, but can you talk a little bit about that, such a wide range of voice that you have?
Well, remember, I've been writing for many decades, and I started publishing poetry in the 1960s, in the era of the Little Mag Revolution, the Mimeo Revolution, they called it at one time, and published hundreds of poems in the Wormwood Review, which I had great respect for with its venerable editor, Marvin Malone. And I wrote a lot of short poems. I wrote a lot of short one-liner punchline poems, if you want, and they often were irreverent. They had the spirit of Dadaism to them. So they were, I think I wrote poems of some sensitivity in those days too, but I think I strove more for insensitivity perhaps than sensitivity. And, and then the 70s, we know, was a different generation, in the 80s, the 90s. Now we're in a new century. And, and I've gone from beginning to publish when I was, say, maybe 22, 23 years old in the magazines to being 68 today. And you don't lose all of what you were in those years, but you do go on into other phases and other things that are of importance to you, and you write what you can write at the time and what you feel like writing at the time, and then you let the chips fall where they may and the poems appear where they will or won't. So I don't direct my poetry through certain phases, but I guess in retrospect you can discover phases or periods.
Right, right. Well, there are so many writers, as you know, who don't write through decades, even really well-known ones or successful ones. And can you say a few words about how it seems like you've started talking about that, but how you sustain that kind of desire and that kind of craft over the years?
I think because I've been writing my whole life. Literally, when I was 3 or 4 years old, I had an Aunt Pat who, when I stayed over at her house, I had many childless aunts who sort of adopted me as their child, would stand me up in the bed and have me look out the window at an early age and have me write, starlight, star bright types of poems. And she would copy them down. I think she had an earlier phase in her life of being with an artsy crowd, maybe, and she always encouraged me. She treated me like a real writer at that very early age, and took me very seriously and fostered that. And my mother was an elementary school teacher who taught me to read and write before I went to kindergarten at the age of 4 and a half. And with that kind of family support, I thought I never could remember thinking that I wasn't going to be a writer. Wow. I was mainly writing school assignments through those years, but I was also getting the support of the teachers because mm-hmm. you know how success breeds success, and and so they supported me also mm-hmm. in that. And I would often think I was going to be something else also, a fireman or a policeman or who knows what, but I never swayed from the idea that I would also be a writer. And so I started out that way, and as the one poem says, they're seeing it through to the end. You know, I'm not going to stop now, I don't think.
Well, good. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Gerald Loughlin. His newest book is entitled New and Selected Poems, published by World Parade Books. So would you read some more poems?
Yes. Would you like some of the shorter ones like
yeah,
that,
that'd be
maybe?
Great.
I'll see what I have here from the new and selected poems because they are arranged chronologically. And we can see the types of things that I was writing back in the 1960s. Now, here's one that was in a forum. You know, it was rhyming quatrains called Toulouse-Lautrec. Since I started out doing a certain number of formal poems, I'd studied metrics fairly carefully in graduate school. And anyway, I was moving to pseudo-forums at times, but this is still in a forum. Toulouse-Lautrec. His Paris was the garden of the satyr. Whores and dancers, debutantes and clowns left the bull a beauty-hater as he made his lowly orange rounds. There was no doubt, of course, he would not live long. Paris was too rich in rhythm, too poor in joy. To drug his mauve despair, he played the boor, his face a lithograph of bottled song. Inevitably, he met his downfall. He fell in love with the ephemeral and blazoned out the sex appeal of Aristide Bruant, of garters, of everything but sex. Today he would again drink his death, being unable to dance the hully-gully at the Whiskey a Go-Go, just as the can-can at the Moulin Rouge deprived his jealous breath. Toulouse-Lautrec, that veritable human wreck, was always out of it. He splashed his soul and made a reputation. Let's hope it was some compensation. Well, that wasn't a terribly short one, but it was a style that I would probably not write in today. As far as, here's a short one. It takes a busy man. He hadn't made a dent in his list for weeks. One of the items was call Z. Then one day Z's wife called to say that Z had died. He was ashamed to catch himself indulging in a feeling of accomplishment as he crossed call Z off his list. From a usually reliable source, as our little boy goes running off to the playground, my wife says to the headmaster, because we were living and teaching in Wales at that time, he lives in his own world. He has not yet entered reality. And the Welsh headmaster tells her not to worry, that her son is just wonderful, and that someday he will turn around and discover he has entered the world of adult reality. And she looks the Welsh headmaster in the eye and says, maybe, but his father never did. My kind of guy. Leaving the downtown bar at closing, I hear this one young guy say to his buddy, you got any beer at your place? And the buddy says, I got some Colombian and a little Coke, and there's a guy right in the neighborhood would bring over some heroin. And the first guy says, yeah, but do you have any beer?
I love, you know, one thing I love about your work is the, you know, the vernacular, this sense of the plain spoken and just the feeling of real that keeps coming and coming. And you know, there's this quote on the back of your new book, your new and selected, that from Edward Field, who I love, talking about the male spirit in him, meaning you, remains honest, big-hearted, sentimental, generous, gentle, vulnerable, but sassy in the face of adversity, qualities that could be applied to as few American poets as to presidents. Which is a great
I was happy with that quote when he said that, and it puts certain things about my writing in the most favorable light possible, I think, you know. And I hope I do represent a male spirit that has not been exterminated, but perhaps has been relegated to the margins in the last 40 years or so. You know, and I think that can be found in the poems. I'm shameless about that. I write from the perspective of a traditional male and of my generation, and it's not a corner of the world that has produced a lot of poetry readers right now. I think
I think it's still pretty healthy.
I don't know. I would think that the readers of poetry today are not necessarily traditional males in general.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the readers.
Yeah, the readers,
the
right.
Readers. Okay.
The readers. I mean, and I had influences, of course, like Field himself, you know.
I love his work. Yeah.
Field himself and his use of vernacular and his use of popular culture and his use of the mixing of levels of discourse. And Charles Bukowski, whom I knew personally and was a friend of, and was definitely a strong influence. But before him, because I was getting my doctorate in literature, so I was reading everybody. And, you know, Wordsworth is striving for the common language, and it comes up in the United States through E.A. Robinson and Frost and Carl Sandburg and Edgar Lee Masters and William Oppen and William Carlos Williams, the Objectivist, and Ginsberg, and then up through through Field and Bukowski and others. So there were a lot of places to find it, and it, you know, it worked its way into my work. One person, ironically, who influenced the short poems a lot was Norman Mailer in a little book of poems of his called "Deaths for the Ladies." I think that I came across when I was in my first year of teaching at LA State at that time, and just these little nuggets of poems which were kind of irreverent and sassy, perhaps, and for some reason, I and my office mate at Long Beach State loved Field stuff and did everything possible to promote his work, and he found things to like in our work as well.
That's great. Well, there's so much a sense of what's alive and genuine in your work. Could you read some more?
Yes.
I want to hear some poems.
Let me see what I have here. Here are a couple from Wedlock Sunday and Other Poems, a recent chapbook. The title poem, Wedlock Sunday. She is working in the garden, facing away from me, trimming the bougainvillea, still trim herself and youthful, relaxed and free of cares, doing something she enjoys, something that she has always enjoyed, and having lost all conception of the passing of the hours. And I feel a tenderness for her that I may never have felt during the selfish passion of young manhood. And I wish the bitternesses that have more than merely punctuated our 30 years together could be magically obliterated, which will never happen, let's not kid ourselves, but perhaps for the rest of this afternoon and evening they will be. I resolve to do and say only kindnesses to her over dinner and in front of the PBS mystery that we've been following, and not to react to any sarcasms or schemes she may slip into out of habit, hunger, Merlot, tiredness, or contemplation of the work week's rattling hours of third graders, parents, colleagues, homework, grades, and art projects, lying once again in wait for her. And another, which Garrison Keillor has used frequently on his radio program, A Writer's Almanac, is the title poem of a little chapbook called The Iceberg Theory. All the food critics hate iceberg lettuce. You'd think romaine was descended from Orpheus's laurel wreath. You'd think raw spinach had all the nutritional benefits attributed to it by Popeye, not to mention aesthetic subtleties worthy of Verlaine and Debussy. They'll even salivate over chopped red cabbage, just to disparage poor old Mr. Iceberg Lettuce. I guess the problem is it's just too common for them. It doesn't matter that it tastes good, has a satisfying crunchy texture, holds its freshness, and has crevices for the dressing, whereas the darker, leafier varieties are often bitter, gritty, and flat. It just isn't different enough, and it's too American. Of course, a critic has to criticize. A critic has to have something to say. Perhaps that's why literary critics purport to find interesting so much contemporary poetry that just bores the pants off of me. At any rate, I really enjoy a salad with plenty of chunky iceberg lettuce, the more the merrier, drenched in an Italian or Roquefort dressing. And the poems I enjoy are those I don't have to pretend that I'm enjoying.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Gerald Loughlin. And he's reading from his new book, New and Selected Poems, published by World Parade Books. You mentioned before, and I think it's pretty common knowledge that you were a good friend of Charles Bukowski's. How big of an influence would you say he was on your work? Or maybe you were an influence on his work more so, who knows?
I wouldn't think that I was an influence more so on his work by any means. I think certain things of mine might have. I think my novella, The Case of the Missing Blue Volkswagen, which he read in the mid-1980s, might have influenced his final book, Pulp. They were both spoofs of the detective fiction, the noir tradition in California, in Southern California, and had many things in common. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it didn't, but there seems to be some evidence that it did. But in his case, he reinforced that whole tendency towards writing in the vernacular and writing about male situations. And, it wasn't so much that I learned originally from him, because I had discovered Edward Field and I'd had all these writers in graduate school that I'd read and all before him when I met him around 1970 and it started reading him around that time. But he certainly reinforced a great deal. He also taught me not how to write poetry, but a path there was for a poetry career, that there was an alternative path, that you didn't have to go through the establishment magazines and the university magazines, that there was a little magazine, small press path that could be followed and could be followed towards, in his case, a great degree of fame. Mm-hmm. And I think that was very important.
Yeah, I mean, can you just say a few words about how you have over 100 books? I mean, how you write over 100 books.
Yeah, probably over 125. You just keep writing a lot and you write in streaks and you become a different type of writer. One thing I have in common with Bukowski, I think, is we write a lot and they're not all going to be masterpieces, and mm-hmm. some will not be worth publishing or typing up even. And so you write a lot and hope that a certain number of them will turn out the way you'd like. Sometimes in an evening you might write 7 or 8 poems and you write yourself into the good ones. And the first mm-hmm. 2 or 3 are no good at all, and then maybe the middle ones are fine, and then the later ones you trail off. That way, I know he always said he liked to write as much as possible and leave it up to the critics to decide and the publishers to decide what was good and what wasn't. His job was to write, and theirs was to evaluate.
Mm-hmm. Well, for you, how does revision figure into that? I mean, in terms of...
It depends on whether you're starting or whether you've been writing for a long time. When I started, I worked over poems more and had to revise more, I think. And But gradually, a lot of things become internalized. You don't have to think about them. You know how students in school will say, well, did T.S. Eliot really think about putting these levels of meaning into something? Well, in the case of Eliot, he really did think mm-hmm. about all those levels of meaning. But in the case of many writers, you don't think about things. They just happen because you've been doing them for years, and you're reading all the time, and you're thinking all the time, and you're trying out lines, and you're developing themes. And
right.
And so I don't revise an awful lot at this stage. I maybe write the thing, maybe I make a second version. I write by hand on pads to start with, and then when I type it up, I'll change some things, and then I send it out.
Okay.
Yep.
We have time for a couple more poems.
Okay. Well, here's one related to the whole theme of the iceberg poems and types of poetry. To our iceberg lettuce, I mean, the false rhapsody of art. A phrase from Ondaatje's English Patient, perhaps why, quote, Odysseus never wrote a word. A purity of mind of the man of action that we of words might emulate. What Pound sought, what William Carlos Williams set out for, to demonstrate we did not need it. That poetry can do quite well without the false. Oppen, Edward Field, Bukowski, they all sought to avoid it while keeping their ears cocked, their voices clear and clean, for the new music of the truth of the never old emotions. I think it's another way of getting at that whole notion of what contemporary poetry can be or perhaps should be. Jerry's Day. It came to me today in the shower how much I prefer February to the other months because it's shorter and that there's no good reason why the other months could not be just as brief as well. We just need more of them. With 13 months, we could fit 364 days in. Then we could have a 14th month of just one day. And two in leap years. Because for 13 months, weeks would remain at 7 days, we'd know at the end of each week that we were 1/4, 1/2, or 3/4 of the way to payday, or at the very day itself. No more of those messy extra days that mean we are not as close to payday as we feel we ought to be. Those 29th and 30th and 31st days of the month that constitute the major cause of bounced checks and deflated celebrations. These would be months that we could trust. Good, solid, honest, manageable months. The kind our earliest ancestors swore by in their caves and barrows. It will be only fitting that the 14th month be named for me and celebrated in my honor, a paid holiday and payday both. And two of them in leap year. Happy Jerry's Day to you.
The poetry of Gerald Loughlin. Thank you so much. It's great.
Thank you, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.